Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. What you're going to listen to today is a show that was organized by Steve of LibertyNet. He came up with this idea, and I was just too happy to be a part of it. And when he told me that Dr. E. Michael Jones is going to be on, I was very keen to be involved in this and to have a chance to talk with him. So although this was about remembering 9/11, there was so much going on that, like a fool, I did not even say where I was on 9/11. And the fact is, I do remember exactly where I was on 9/11. On 9/11, I was sitting at work, and I was working for a small company in Rosebank, and cell phones were still a very new thing, and I think I had a little Nokia cell phone, and all you could do with it other than call was send text messages, which was already an awesome thing back then. And I was sitting at work, and it was in the afternoon. It was like about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is about 9 a.m. in New York, when sometime between 3 and 4, I got a text message from my friend Gilbert, and Gilbert said he's at home watching TV because we had CNN back then. He was watching live TV, and an aircraft had flown into a tower. Well, I didn't know about the size, the enormous size of towers in America. Here in Johannesburg, we've got two towers, and they are thin things that you climb into and you ride up to the top. And at the top is a restaurant. This is from the time of the good days of South Africa, when white South Africa was at its peak in the 60s and 70s. So when I heard the term tower, I was thinking of that kind of tower, a tall, thin tower. And I imagined what kind of aircraft would fly into it. I thought to myself, it must be something like a small Cessna, little two-seater Cessnas flown into a tower. And Gilbert was sending me text messages and saying, the tower is on fire, there's smoke coming out of it. And then about 30 minutes later, Gilbert sends a message and he says, the tower has collapsed, and I don't know what to make of it. So I couldn't picture in my mind what was going on, but Gilbert was very excited about it. He was seeing some awesome stuff. So I couldn't wait to finish work and to get home. And I got home by 6 p.m. and watched the news, and there was the film footage of the events of that horrific day. Kevin Alfred Strom mentions that he knew there and then that Jews had something to do with this rubbish. But back then I was stupid. I only worried about communism, never even gave a second thought to issues like Jews. So I didn't even have a clue of how horrific the story behind the story was. I just took it at face value. Bunch of Muslims did this. Never even imagined explosions, blowing up the buildings, thermite melting steel. Never even imagined any of those things. But it was a very horrific thing to see, and the nasty things that went down. And we even spoke about whether this could cause a world war and that kind of thing. We knew that this thing is going to result in big things. Little did we know, little did I know, that this is really just something from the Jews to get Americans riled up to go and killing Muslims by the millions across the Middle East. That is the real game here. I'm not going to comment further on the show, though there are things that are raised in this show that I might well mention when I do other videos. The only thing that I'm going to mention here is that I do understand the situation of the church and a church like the Catholic Church. I do understand that because of the church having lots of non-whites, that the church, because it's global, the church has to watch how it talks and the messages it puts out. And the church, the Catholic Church, is big in Africa, by the way. There are large numbers of blacks who are Catholics. Even a guy like Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, the communist we hated, he was educated in a Catholic school. He was educated by white Catholics in Rhodesia. So the Catholics are all over Africa. I do therefore understand, let's call it church diplomacy and the church approach to these things. And also, as Alex Linda has said, Catholic means general and that it's available for everybody. So I do understand that. Even so, I do want to talk about the issue of race. The issue of race came up a lot, and E. Michael Jones made it clear what his stance is on race. But I want to tell you that I have looked at American academics, and I've been looking at American history, and I've been doing some thinking about this. And the American approach to race is to not speak about it. I've seen this again and again, that the American approach to race from academics and from politicians is to not speak about it and hope that by not speaking about it, that this is the best way to deal with it. And I do want to emphasize, and you will hear me saying it in the show, I do want to emphasize, race is real. When I say race is real, I'm saying that it doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter how you approach this thing, whether you talk about it or whether you don't talk about it. And if you try to avoid it constantly, you can do that up to your eyeballs. But race is real, and race comes out, and even if you do not mention it, it will come to you. Those other races in America, especially the blacks, let me warn you, the issue of race is an issue you cannot avoid endlessly. And if the white man keeps backtracking all the time, the white man will always be on the run. And that is something that I am trying to give people input on. Because being on the run all the time is wrong. And in America, whites are literally, physically on the run. So in America, I know about white flight, etc. But this thing is even deeper than that. It is like a mental inability to deal with this. And I think I know the answer. I know why this has come about. But I'm going to deal with this in a video that I'm going to do about Ian Smith of Rhodesia, because Ian Smith spoke to Americans, and you need to hear what Ian Smith found out about America in the 1970s and 1980s. There is a place that I read where Nietzsche, the philosopher, warned of wars that would come regarding human ability. I can't remember whether he mentioned race specifically, but I remember he did mention it. I did come across it when I was looking into some of his writings a few years ago. So that's the only thing that I want to say in this video. The show is good fun. It really went well. And I was absolutely delighted to be invited onto this show. And I've told LibertyNet, you can call me anytime for any similar kind of show. I really enjoyed it. It was good fun. We really came out and said what we wanted to say. And you'll hear the many things that Dr. E. Michael Jones has to say about the Jews. This was my recording, and I actually started recording before the show started originally. So I actually left a little bit of this, of the beginning of it, in here, because you'll hear Steve talking and saying some things. And when I actually looked at the recording, I was quite shocked to see that my voice had not come out well on this show. I think I was talking too softly into my microphone and not realizing how softly I really was speaking. And when I listened to the original recording, I was quite horrified at how bad it was. So I actually went in this audio and I fixed the whole audio so that I'm a lot louder. And I will have to be careful when I do shows again. I need to see to it that I don't make this mistake again. It was really silly. Anyhow, here's the show. Enjoy. It's good fun. Lots of meat in there for everybody.
Liberty Net team up. It's going to be commencing in a couple of minutes. Already we have both our guests warming up here in the voice on the voice server and a little bit going on in chat. And basically, this is a special event for the Liberty Net. It's the Liberty Net team up, and it's a idea that I thought up sort of on a short schedule where I was thinking about 9/11 and what would be a good kind of special treat for us to hear on the Liberty Net. And I had been pursuing Mr. Jones for quite a while and watching his shows, I think on Friday, I think it was on Cozy TV, and a lot of interesting topics that he brought up regarding things that we talk about quite a bit on our Liberty Nets every Saturday. And I kind of kept in touch with him. And I also thought of Jan Lamprecht, who's been on our show a couple of times. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if I could get both of them together? I wonder what the back and forth and the ideas and comments would be, and especially on 9/11, the day that we remember and probably won't ever forget. And it marks 23 years of the worst terror attack on U.S. soil, and our country was definitely changed in a completely different way. A lot of different things took place after 9/11 that were very unprecedented. So I thought, you know, why not pick 9/11 as the day to talk about these things and try to connect them all together. So pretty much we're going to be starting right about now. I guess it's 5:30. It looks like the guests are kind of familiar with the audio system here. And Kevin Strom, WB4AIO, is pretty much going to be the guests once we get going. And we're live streaming this on 3950.net right now, the home of the Liberty Nets. And we've also got a chat room on that site running. And I believe most likely it's also heading over to the MyTuner Radio show, the MyTuner Radio site for the mobile apps. So, yes, yeah, the normal, pretty much all the normal Liberty Net stuff is going, except that this is mostly just kind of a special event. It's not really done on at the same time as the Liberty Net on Saturday. So only the real core members and those who are really interested in the Liberty Net will be, I guess, listening and trying to participate.
Well, we'll be streaming it throughout the week, too.
Right, it'll be you'll be recording it and putting it in the playlist.
And it will be available for download on our website also.
Right.
Okay, well, it is thank you for the introduction, Steve. Let me give very brief introductions here in the in our chat room. We have you, of course, Steve KA2PTE, Natalie, our Canadian correspondent, and we will be entertaining questions from them later in the show. Our two guests are writer, publisher, revolutionary thinker, Dr. E. Michael Jones, also with many substantial academic credentials. And also we have from South Africa, Jan Lamprecht, another revolutionary thinker, activist, and writer. And welcome to the program, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for joining our program. And Jan Lamprecht, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me back on your show. It's an honor to be here. And it's a double honor with Professor Jones being here as well.
Thank you, Jan. Now, I initially in my conversations with Steve, we talked about making 9/11, the events of 9/11, which in my opinion was an operation that had Jewish fingerprints all over it, into the main topic of discussion. However, back channel communications before the show indicated that perhaps we really ought to widen it out somewhat beyond just 9/11. Also, certainly there's nothing to bar us from discussing that topic. But the topic, I think, as I see it at this point, and you gentlemen, feel free to digress, as I have full confidence in your intellectual ability to do so intelligently and on point, is Jewish power. And are Jews the enemy, as some have said in recent years? To address those ideas, your initial remarks, Dr. Jones.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you did broaden it out, because I think that 9/11 is a subset of the Jewish takeover of American culture. So it fits in perfectly. So to get to the question specifically, are Jews the enemy? The answer is yes. I'm basing this, saying this as a Catholic, basing it on the statement of St. Paul's II, which is where St. Paul said the Jews are the people who killed Christ and they are enemies of the entire human race. This is now after the behavior of the Israelis in Gaza, this abominable behavior, which is going on for about a year now. This is an empirical fact. We cannot deny this fact. Their behavior is beyond the pale of any civilized person, any civilized culture on the face of this earth. And the frustration we all feel and our inability to stop this is palpable throughout the world now, culminating in all sorts of last-ditch attempts on the part of the Jews who control the media to block speech. Candace Owens just got canceled off of YouTube. So it's obvious now, and all I'd say is, well, what's our response? Well, the response, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Christian, and the response is that we have to love our enemies. This means, what does this mean? This doesn't mean that we capitulate to our enemies' demands. It doesn't mean that we internalize the commands of our oppressors. It means, first and foremost, that we speak up for the truth. And the truth at this point is denouncing their uncivilized behavior. We have to be forthright here, because the Jew has to be brought back into reality here. Instead of pretending that this, what is going on there, is in some sense, that's the first thing we have to do. We have to bring them back to reality. We have to have the courage to confront the Jew as our enemy and express some love for our enemy by urging him to accept the truth, and then accept, I, as a Christian, I would say the ultimate truth, which is that Jesus Christ came as the Jewish Messiah, and that they've been in rebellion against the Jesus Christ for over 2,000 years now, and it's time to end that rebellion. It's going to end one way or the other. The Jews are haunted by, the Israelis are haunted by the fact that no Jewish kingdom has lasted more than 80 years. They are acting in this way, I think, out of a sense of desperation and panic, okay? And we have to do whatever we can deal with this critical moment in history by providing a peaceful transition, a transition to a more peaceful world, which would mean probably the end of Israel and the end of the American empire. So they're my thoughts on that.
Okay, Mr. Lamprecht, your initial thoughts.
Yes. Well, 9/11 was a huge slaughter of Americans on American soil. And, you know, one of the things about Jews as a people is they play big games at a high level. You know, Jews, the kinds of scale on which Jews think, and if I look at Jews that I knew personally and how they think, they don't think small. Jews think big. And when they do think it on a scale that is astounding. And, you know, Hitler, for example, pointed out in Mein Kampf that the common white person will think of a small lie and will tell a little lie. But the normal person would never conceive that someone would come out and tell an enormous, bold lie on a massive scale and just throw it right out there in front of everybody. And if you, and 9/11 is an example, you know, Jews aren't busy murdering one or two people. They came and they slaughtered thousands. They did it on TV. They did it with grandeur. They spread it around the world. They pumped in lies about everything relating to it. And it's amazing the things that these people get up to. And I will tell you that when I look at some of the things that they've done, I did a video some time back about Jews as a form of human evolution. And Kevin, in this regard, I was thinking a lot about some of the issues you'd raised on previous programs about Jewish power. And I went and I looked at Jews from the point of view of biology as an animal, because humans are also animals. And I've come to the conclusion that Jews are a very strange form of evolution that have developed in Europe. And they've developed a niche. And in that niche, they function in a way where they are very close to European people. They know European people extremely well, and they know how to manipulate European people in a way that is horrific. And this problem is a problem that doesn't go away. And this problem is back again. And I must tell you, when I look at these things, I can't see a pleasant solution to any of these things.
Very good. Thank you, Jan. I think I failed to introduce myself. I'm Kevin Strom, and my amateur call sign is WB4AI. I'm also the host of the program that Jan was referring to that he was listening to, and that's American Dissident Voices, which I've been doing for about 33 years now. And okay, well, we've got two perspectives here, a religious perspective. Perhaps in my own mind, I can to some extent harmonize the two. I don't deny the spiritual perspective at all, but I do mainly think in biological terms. And I would ask you, Dr. Jones, you said that the answer is to identify your enemy and deal with your enemy. Does dealing with our enemy, if we see the Jewish power structure or the Jewish religion as the enemy of all peoples, especially, I would say, our people, the European people, what do we do about it? You emphasized convincing them to accept Christianity, to change their religion. Does that mean you want a scenario in which Judaism comes to an end, or is there more to it?
Yes, I do want Judaism to come to an end. Where do I begin with this? I begin at the foot of the cross, which is where I contest the racial narrative, because the racial narrative simply can't explain the beginning of Judaism, the modern Judaism, which has happened after the destruction of the temple. Okay, because it was a civil war among Jews. They all had the same DNA, and one group decided that they understood that Jesus Christ was the Messiah and were following him, and they stopped being Jews the minute they accepted baptism. The other group decided to kill him. And they are the people that are known as Jews. Jesus Christ was the Logos incarnate. The Logos is the order of the universe, which means that the Jews, by calling for the death of Christ, call for the end of Logos. They declare war on Logos, which is the order of the universe, which means, what do you call those people? They're called revolutionaries. And we have been suffering at the hands of the Jewish revolutionary spirit now for 2,000 years. There is only one way to get rid of this problem, and that is to get rid of the Jews. And there's only one way to get rid of the Jews, by having them convert to Christianity, to accept the Messiah they did not accept 2,000 years ago. Because if you want to try the other way, it's not going to work. And the best thing that ever happened to Jews in the 20th century was National Socialism's attempt to deal with them in a non-spiritual fashion. Okay, I've said this to my friend Gilad Atman, the famous Israeli saxophonist. He, like many Jews, he senses that Israel is about to go under. There's something. No Jewish kingdom has lasted longer than 80 years. Ehud Barak, former prime minister, has said this. There's a sense of doom just over the horizon. And I think it's true. I said there are only two options, and both of them involve the disappearance of the Jews. Either, and the options are Masada, which is the hill after which the Jews, the Jewish revolutionaries in 70 AD, they retired to this hill, they retreated to the hill, and instead of fighting off the Romans, they committed suicide. Now, why the Jews commemorate this is beyond my understanding. But so that's one option. Of getting rid of the Jews, which I think is now what's happening with Israel. It may not seem that way at the moment, but the Israelis are committing suicide right now because of their fanatical policies. And I'm saying there's a better alternative, and that is baptism. In other words, once the Jew accepts baptism, he's no longer a Jew. That's the Catholic solution. That's the solution I'm advocating. But I think that we're at a moment where there are no other options. We have gone too far. They have gone too far. Everyone has gone too far. We cannot continue with this understanding that, oh, they're just like everyone else. They are not like everyone else. They are a totally unique group in history. Their revolutionary spirit has fueled one catastrophe after another throughout human history. And now I just have this feeling that we're at a moment of showdown, the final showdown.
Well, I can feel the passion in what you say. I have to say, though, I find it hard to conceive in my mind somebody like Harvey Weinstein or Jeffrey Epstein accepting baptism as a solution to the situation. Or Benjamin Netanyahu, for that matter. I find it hard to conceive of that.
All things are possible with God, and this has happened already. So there was at the end of the Middle Ages. There were rabbis converting, and the rabbis would convert, and then they would have disputations, the disputation of Tortosa, where they would call rabbis in, and they'd say, now this is, I'm a rabbi, I know what's in the Talmud, how do you defend this passage where it says that Jesus Christ is buried up to his neck in excrement, and the son of a whore? And the rabbi would say, well, it's not that Jesus, it's ridiculous. They lost total credibility among their own people, and there were mass conversions in the late Middle Ages. So much so that basically the Jew had been totally eliminated from Western Europe. Either they converted, or they went to Poland, and that's where they settled. Okay, there were so many Jews converting to the Catholic Church, and bishops are saying, "What are we going to do with all these synagogues?" Now, that was not without everything is full of problems. And it led to another problem, which was the Converso crisis in Spain, where some Jews simply converted. They were not sincere. And that caused big problems of its own. But I'm saying there's precedent for this happening. And I'm saying when you're dealing with the realm of the supernatural, anything is possible. I don't know. I don't understand. I don't see Benjamin Netanyahu converting anytime soon. But I'm not God. And God understands the way this works. And I think if we simply eliminate God from this understanding. First of all, you're never going to understand the Jews unless you understand who Jesus Christ is as the Logos incarnate and why they hate him. And how that drives, that is the only source of Jewish identity. It's negative. It's hatred of Logos. And that led to this revolutionary spirit that is now, I think, coming to an end.
Thank you very much for that explanation. I have a better perspective of where you're coming from now. I guess I look at it a little bit more from a biological perspective. I see it as a parasitic culture, a parasitic religion, a religion that deifies their parasitic relationship. And as you say, their hate-filled relationship with the rest of the world. But I'm just the interviewer here, so I'm not going to go on too much about what I think. I want to get Mr. Lamprecht's further impressions on what you said. Go ahead, Jan.
Thank you. It was very interesting what you said, Professor Jones. The one thing that I do want to point out about Jews and converting, you also have Martin Luther, who wrote the book of the Jews and their lies. And when I went through that, it appeared to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it appeared to me as if Martin Luther, when he set out to create Protestantism, it appears to me as if Martin Luther had been very friendly to the Jews and he had spoken to the Jews. And he was under the impression that if he creates Protestantism, that the Jews will convert to Protestantism rather than, you know, going Catholic. That he understood this.
I think you're absolutely right. That is exactly what Luther was saying. I mean, there's a little bit of egomania here, too. I mean, that no one had ever preached the gospel until Martin Luther came along. No one had ever preached it correctly. And so one, now that he is the spokesman for Christianity, the Jews are just going to be amazed at his eloquence and they're all going to convert. I think that's exactly what he felt. And then he was disappointed. And then he wrote the last statement, the second statement on the Jews, where he was full of anger. You can't understand Luther without understanding his inability to control his passions. One of them was lust, that's why he married that nun. Another one was drink, and another one was anger. And that anger came out in the last statement of the Jews, where he basically violated the compact that the church had made with the Jews in Sicut Judaeus Non, which is basically that no one, state church said, no one has the right to harm the Jew, but at the same time, no Jew has a right to destroy Christian culture, to undermine the morals of the people, or to ridicule the Christian faith. So he broke that compact. He broke a lot of compacts. That's why we have the Reformation. You're right. You're absolutely right. He felt that the Jews were going to convert because of his eloquence.
Well, what I wanted to say, thank you very much for confirming that, Professor Jones. What I wanted to point out was, yes, that he believed the Jews, he spoke to the Jews, he dealt with the Jews, he believed that he finally had gotten through to the Jews, and that if he did something, that they would then convert. And the end result was they lied to him, and he was enraged over the matter. And, you know, that to me is just one of many examples of the problem that you have with whites, especially European people dealing with Jews. When Jews are in a corner or Jews need to get something done, you've got a very disingenuous discussion that takes place, a discussion where the Europeans think that they are finally making some headway with the Jews, and the Jews will just lie and twist, and the next thing you know is they'll be back again. And in this regard, you've got the same problem with the Spanish, with those Jews that became the conversos, who fake converted in order to just fool the Spanish for however long they needed to fool them. Another place where I came across this is, I'm quite a fan of Napoleon, and just out of interest in his life. I read lots and lots of books about Napoleon, and I came across Napoleon's run-in with the Jews. When Napoleon was at the height of his power, he was trying to do all kinds of things across Europe. In fact, yesterday I was just reading where Napoleon was talking to people in his final exile about his plans for creating a confederation of European states. That was one of his ideas. But Napoleon was basically the guy who became the front man for the French Revolution, because the French Revolution would have failed. It would have failed due to the attacks on France. But when Napoleon saved the French Revolution and ended up becoming the emperor, Napoleon then tried to sort out things. He did many things in many countries, but at a point he was clearly full of confidence, and Napoleon decided to solve the Jewish problem. So Napoleon went and he dug into the issue, and he used his powers to call a Sanhedrin of the Jews, invite Jewish rabbis from across Europe, and he started talking to these people. And Napoleon was clearly quite serious about this, because the French Revolution, as part of it, they had also emancipated the Jews. Anyway, Napoleon was busy and he was dealing with these Jews. And then after he had questioned them and dealt with them for quite some time, Napoleon did a strange thing. He went and issued some edicts, and the Jews have got terrible names for the edicts that he issued, but he issued a number of edicts against the Jews. He stopped them from doing certain things, banned them from doing other things. He clearly came out of the process in the same way as Martin Luther, where Napoleon must have realized that the Jews are a bunch of lying scum, and that any kind of discussion that you have with these people, no matter how you try to deal with them, you just can't do it. And another thing that I just want to mention as well, when you were saying about Jews converting, here in South Africa, I've done quite a lot of digging into South African history and the Jews, and it's amazing how much stuff about Jews and South Africa has been hidden away for the last 100 or more years. But the Jewish role in South Africa, the original thing where the Jews got into South Africa, were the Rothschilds encouraging the British to go to war against the Boer republics, because the Boer republics had about 25% of the world's gold in their small republics.
Yes, I agree. It's your own damn fault, because all that you've put all that gold and diamonds under your soil, and that's going to be a magnet for Jews. So it's your own damn fault. George Galloway. Went there to South Africa to combat apartheid. Every single person who took them around trying to overthrow the government was a Jew. So yes, he has substantiated that fact. But if I could go back to the Converso crisis, you're right. There was the Jews did lie. The rabbis told the Jews, you don't have to be sincere. You can lie to those people. You can accept baptism with your fingers crossed. And there's nothing wrong with that. That was had a devastating effect on that whole process, because the Christian authorities could not tell whether the Jews were lying or not. Now, saying that, I am not saying that there were not sincere conversions. There were sincere conversions. If you're saying they were all insincere, that's not right. And the man who will contest that is Bibi Netanyahu's father, who Ben Zion Netanyahu wrote a book about the conversos in Spain, and said most of them were sincere. So if you're saying that there were no sincere conversions, I will contest that. If you're saying that the rabbis told them to lie, I would agree with that. That's exactly what happened. And I think the same thing happened in France with Napoleon. Napoleon assembled the Jews. He got the modern day Sanhedrin together and he said, will you support France? And the Jews all said, jusqu'à la mort, until death, we will support France. They were lying. They were lying. And so Napoleon goes off happy that he got the Jews on board. He fights the Battle of Jena. He comes back to Strasbourg. By the time he gets back in Strasbourg, all the French are upset because the Jews are exploiting their new position as citizens. I think that the conclusion that we have to draw from that experience of Napoleon is that no Jew can become a citizen. This was the position, the universal position of Europe at that point. Napoleon broke the mold because he was a revolutionary, and then he realized he'd done something wrong and he had to try and repair it. The modern day example of this is the United States of America right now. We're coming to the end of Biden administration, where the Jewish newspapers would talk about Biden's minion. There were 10 Jews in the cabinet alone. There were 457 Jews in the Biden administration. And what you saw time and time again was that no Jew can represent the interest of the American people. They always represent Jewish interests against the American people. I'm talking about Alejandro Mayorkas, who is basically representing the position of the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society by flooding immigrants across our border, violating what he's supposed to be doing. I'm talking about Merrick Garland, the Attorney General of the United States of America, who as soon as he becomes head of law enforcement in America, goes after Catholic pro-lifers to the point where Senator Josh Hawley had to haul him in front of the Senate and say, why are you going after Catholics? And I would never do that because I have relatives who died in the Holocaust. Well, no, we know this is the conclusion we have to draw right now. No dual citizens in the United States government. That's the first step. But the real premise goes back to Napoleon. Jews cannot be citizens. We have to go back to the traditional wisdom of Europe, which never allowed these people to become citizens. They were always resident aliens.
That's very awesome. And I totally agree. I also just want to quickly say that in South Africa, the Jews played many nefarious roles against the whites in South Africa. Exactly as you say, with George Galloway and all that. I did videos about Nelson Mandela being a Jewish creation. He was a communist terrorist, etc. And also the biggest secret in South Africa is that people are unaware that the only assassination of a prime minister that ever took place in South Africa was something orchestrated by Jews. A particular Jewish communist was the main prime mover in it. And it's one of the greatest secrets here in South Africa. Very few people know about it. But what I wanted to point out was that after the Jews actually killed the most important white leader that we had in South Africa, Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, after the Jews had killed our best guy, the Jews then befriended the whites, especially the Afrikaners, and started embracing them in many ways, and this continued on for decades. And in the mid-1980s, the wealthiest Jewish family in Africa, the Oppenheimers, and the Oppenheimers are so wealthy that in the 1960s they did a study, and the results of the study was that the Oppenheimers alone owned about 70% of all the South African economy, one family. Anyway, in the 1980s, when the government was very friendly with the Jews, there was a statement that came out in the newspapers all of a sudden, one day, a strange statement which said that the Oppenheimer family have converted to Christianity. And I can tell you, decades later, it's total nonsense. People in South Africa, and you know, the Afrikaners are very Christian, and they were very friendly to these people. And meanwhile, these people were lying to them, stabbing them in the back all the way right to the end. And I do.
In the American South, there's a parallel to that too. In the American South, the Jews at first befriended the white aristocracy of the South before stabbing them in the back with the civil rights movement.
The same behavior over and over again. I do agree with you, Professor Johns. All the old things that whites used to do in Europe are dead right. And yes, Jews cannot be citizens. I even heard somewhere that European courts did not allow Jews to be witnesses because they lie so much. So, you know, all those things come up.
Yeah, the people that had the best modus vivendi were the Poles. And they basically gave the Jews their own legal system. Probably for the reasons that you mentioned. Because I don't know how it dealt with, like, if there were a legal case between a Christian and a Jew. I'm sure that was adjudicated in a Christian court. But the problem there was I think they had the most sophisticated approach to the whole Jewish thing, all the way up to Cardinal Blount, which is in the 1930s, who basically talked about secret Judaeus not. He didn't use the term, but he did do a pastoral letter on the Jews in 1938, and he said, "Well, pretty much, yeah, they're bad people, but we can't succumb to these alien ideologies." He was talking about the Germans, the Nazis, at this point, you know. And then he goes through the whole deal, you know, that these people can be sincere at converting, but in the meantime, you should feel free to boycott their businesses, which is exactly what was happening in Germany at the time. But you can't give this kind of racial definition because you can't change your DNA. Can't do it. And so if once you have the racial definition of what a Jew is, then you're frozen into a position where you have to eliminate the Jew. And he said that's not permissible. And that has been, that allows for a modus vivendi where you can control the Jews. You can let them live in peace. You're not supposed to violate their services. You can live in peace, but they have to be brought under control of the Christian leadership at this point. So what happened over this period of time is that the Christians lost their faith. And at that point, once they weakened in their faith, the Jew is ready to rush in and offer the money. You know, I'll lend you money. And that was precisely the crisis that happened in England during the whole 19th century. They wanted big houses. You know, they're land rich and cash poor. Well, that's all made for the Jews. And so the Jew comes in, the Rothschild, Natty Rothschild comes in, lends the Churchill family money so they can build their big mansion. And then suddenly Randolph Churchill can't pay it back. And then he dies. And there's Winston, his son. And they're saying he died £70,000 in debt to Natty Rothschild. And then they come to Winston and they say, you know, well, forget it. We'll just let it go. No, they didn't let it go. Winston Churchill became a pawn of the Jews at that moment. Like his father, he could never live within his means. And during this period of time, the Jews consistently bailed out Winston Churchill as long to the end, because he was always willing to do Jewish bidding, causing havoc throughout the 20th century because of that.
Yeah, Winston.
A friend of mine. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Churchill, believe it or not, when I went to school in Rhodesia, and the high school I went to was Churchill High School. Apparently, it was the first high school that was named after Winston Churchill, I assume in the colonies or whatever. Anyway, so we were inundated with Winston Churchill stuff and what an awesome guy he was, etc. But the truth of the matter is that Winston Churchill destroyed the British Empire. That is the truth.
Yeah. So Tucker Carlson just got in trouble because he had a man on who questioned Winston Churchill's status as a great saint of the 20th century. He was a wicked man. Certainly his behavior in World War II was wicked. And the whole conspiring with Lord Grey when he was Lord of the Admiralty to lure Germany into a war because Germany was ready to make an alliance with Russia. This is the cause of so much woe in the 20th century, and it's related to Jewish interests.
As is so much. A friend of mine who is a cosmotheist philosopher, a man named Fred Streed, once told me that he thought that the Jews were sent by the Creator to test us with a nearly insoluble problem. I guess he was saying that the Jews were our Gordian knot. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Jones?
It depends on which period of Jewish history you're talking about. So if you're talking about the period before Christ, the Jews were God's chosen people. Does that mean they behaved admirably all the time? No, of course not. The biggest Jewish history, Hebrew, let's say Hebrew history, is full of apostasy. Their feet weren't even dry from crossing the Red Sea when they started worshiping the golden calf, Moloch, when Moses was up on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments. So it was full of apostasy, but God was faithful to what he said to the Jews. You are the chosen people. The chosen people then had the test when Jesus Christ arrived. Are you going to accept the long-promised Messiah on his terms? And some did, and they're known as Christians, and some didn't, and they're known as Jews. And that's where the Jewish revolutionary spirit began. So you have to distinguish here between what Hebrew, I'd say, let's in shorthand, Hebrews and Jews.
What are your thoughts on Mr. Streed's idea, Jan?
I think he's dead right. The way that I see Jews, I see them as a very highly specialized form of human parasite that developed in Europe. There are two problem peoples that came out of Europe that Europeans could never solve ever. And the one is Jews and the other one is the gypsies. But whereas the gypsies are almost like a normal street criminal, the Jews are a very different entity. And I think that another guy who really had an insight into Jews was the guy who wrote the White Man's Bible. And in there, he even quotes a little thing out of the Bible. And there's one Bible quote that he comes up with that I think also gives a deep insight into these Jews. And it had to do with, Dr. Jones will differ with me on this, but I want to just tell you, in the Bible, there's a thing that says, where it says, the word of God, the word is God. And what he was saying was that this piece in the Bible is basically indicating that Jews know the power of the word. And if you look at Jews, these are people who play with us and they play with manipulating us. If you look at everything to do with Jews, Jews are involved in business, and look at the roles of Jews in psychology and all these other things. And when I look at Jews, I see them as a specialized kind of human. I see them as a lower human, by the way. I see them as more stupid than as dumber than whites are. So I think Jews are dumber than whites, and that, but they have learned, they have seen that European civilization is an awesome thing, that Europeans function in a very structured way, and they've seen that if they can get into European civilization, that they can also get a piece of the action. And they lust after it, they want it badly, and they are not intelligent enough to do things the way that we do it. So what they've done is they've evolved in such a way that they have found ways to play with us and to manipulate us. And the crux of their approach is all based on wordplay. They play with words, whether it's business, whether it's writing, whether it's spiritual, and And when they are cornered, if you truly corner them and you get them into a spot, then they have ways of squirming out of it, or worst case scenario, they just lie. And they are specialists at liars. They've got 1,001 ways of lying. One of the things that I've pointed out in the past is I regard the art of sophistry among Jews as one of the most advanced things that you can get, because sophistry is when you make an argument that sounds logical, but it isn't. And if you look at the way these people go through society and the things they will say in politics, in media, etc., there are huge amounts of sophistry that Jews use literally every day, and it fools millions and millions of whites. But this parasite is a very specialized animal, and it's got ways of defending itself when it's in trouble. So it taps into our weaknesses. So for example, we can feel sorry for it. So we don't go to slaughter them. But if we hit them and we hurt them, then we also look at them and we feel sorry for them. And then we don't go in to destroy them and annihilate them. And they play on all of our things. You know, when I look at the ways in which they deal with us, that by itself is a very complex topic. But one of the problems is that we do not solve the problem outright. But in the past we have. Take, for example, the Spanish Inquisition, and when the Spaniards kicked the Jews out. Jews were thrown out of Spain for 500 years. I look on that and I say to myself, that is the most successful that any group of whites has ever dealt with the Jews. But when it comes to Hitler, Hitler's in a whole other league by himself. Then Hitler is basically a scientist. Hitler is an academic and a scientist. Many people think Hitler's stupid. That's all junk. Hitler was extremely, extremely clever, and he understood history deeply. And Hitler realized that here you've got a very specific thing and a very specific group, and they function in a certain way. And something that I must also add in quickly is that the way that Jews live among whites, where they come in as a community and they've got all their little tricks. Oh, you see, we're a different religion. So then already religion is one issue. Then they say we're a religion and we're special and we also need our ability to practice our religion. But what you don't realize is that inside that religion is something much more nefarious. And the key thing that I think whites have realized time and time again, especially it was brought up with the emancipation of the Jews in the early 1800s, is that when Jews come into your country, they come in as a state within a state. They work in such a way that you cannot assimilate them. It's like you've imported a cancer into your country. And now you've got a cancer that lives inside your country. These people are so specialized, and they know that they function inside your country, and they start pulling your strings, and they can cause huge mayhem. And one of the things that I've heard. I'll finish off. And one of the things that I've heard is that Europeans have said that Jews are capable of creating a lot of mischief. And I thought, Dr. Jones, maybe you could enlighten us on that.
Heinrich Graetz is the father of Jewish historiography. He was a German. I've cited his book repeatedly in my book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. And he has this famous passage there where he said, the only thing Jews learned from Polish Jews, he said specifically, learned from studying the Talmud is how to cheat people. This is not biological. It's religious. The Talmud is not DNA. It's the heart of the Jewish people, and it's a set of toxic beliefs that got created after the crucifixion, after 500 years after the death of Christ. This is
but
the
Dr.
source.
Dr. Jones, don't those beliefs attract people with a certain kind of mental confirmation, though, and repel others with a different mental confirmation? And doesn't there therefore happen to develop a certain biological difference between the groups?
No, they're two different things. This is materialism. This is people who are confusing, who can't distinguish between the brain and the mind. Okay, they're two different entities. You need a brain to have a mind, but they're two different things. The brain is a piece of meat with electrochemical reactions. The mind transcends all of those things. Okay, we have to hammer this out right now, because if we don't, we're going to end up in the same problem we had in the past. Okay, you cannot, if once you frame this issue in biological terms, you have to go down the road to extermination. And we've already gone down that road, and it's not going to work. And it's not the wrong road to begin with. So I'm saying we have to back away from the biological determinist route. Biological determinism cannot explain the civil war among Jews at the time of Christ. They all had the same DNA. And one group of Jews worshiped him as God, the other group killed him. And there's no biological explanation of that.
If I may say something.
Well, I'm one of those. Okay, go ahead, Jan.
Let me just, I have to take a moment here. I'll be right back. So you two talk. I'll be right back.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Jan.
I actually wanted to say something directly to the issue he was raising there. Let me just say it.
Okay, if you want to wait until he comes back, I can say something in the meantime, if you like.
Go for it.
Okay, I was just going to say that in many ways, I view the Jewish biological structure, the Jewish entity, as an anti-fragile device. It's anti-fragile. If you try to kill it, it makes its elements of hatred of the other, hatred of us, hatred of the world stronger, and it makes it delve underground more deeply, where it can emerge later. If you try to convince it that it is wrong, yes, you will convert some Jews to civilization. You will convert some to decency. Some will be converted sincerely to other religions. I agree with that. However, there is a certain core, those with the tendencies to this hatred of the other, this parasitic behavior, who have that in the greatest degree. And so when you convert those Jews to decency, civilization, or a better religion, you're merely taking the weak away, the weakly Jewish, away from the Jewish biological entity. And the ones that remain are much stronger in their hatred of the rest of the world and in their parasitic behavior.
Kevin, I agree with all of what you say, and it's you and I are on the same wavelength regarding the biological issue, because I also see it very much as a biological issue. It's very important. But one thing that I did notice in Dr. Jones's writings, and it's something that I do want to raise it on this show a bit later, but the issue of race is a hot potato, and I see that it is a very serious issue, and I do have a few points that I want to make about it later, because I've been looking at some other academic stuff from America, but
It's 6:20 right now, just to let you know. Okay. They might. All right.
Yeah, we're probably going to go until around 7, but in about 20 minutes, I want to ask and see if anybody has questions for you two. So that's where we are with that.
Okay.
Yes,
I'm back.
Dr. Jones back. Okay. Dr. Jones, you were saying that there's no biological way of explaining why Jews fought each other. But I do want to say to you, because I noticed in your writings and in the way that you speak, you know the consequences of many things, and I can see that you're trying to head off some nasty conclusions, etc. And I also do understand your position in the Catholic Church, and that the Catholic Church is a global organization with lots and lots of non-European people in it, I did a bit of digging, and it seems like about a third of the Catholic Church is, let's say, European or Caucasian. But one thing I do want to say about race that I've seen here in Africa is that, here in South Africa, we've got not just whites, we've got blacks, we've got mixed race people, we've got Asians, we've got Indian people who live here who are basically Asians. They came here as slaves. And, you know, one thing I want to tell you about all humans, and this is more from an evolutionary point of view, which I know won't interest you, but I do want to say that one thing I've noticed about all humans is that it doesn't matter whether you are white or black or Jews or anyone else, is that you will find that any group of humans, that when they have to come together to determine their future or to decide which way to go, you will find that all humans naturally can argue intensely with each other, and it can get to the point where they will murder or kill each other, or you can even get all-out war where they slaughter each other. If you take the Roman Empire, for example, the Romans had some very bloody civil wars among themselves in order to resolve issues. And one of the things that I see about all humans is that it is part of our minds that our minds have evolved in such a way that if you put 100, whether you take 100 Swiss people or 100 blacks and put them into a room and you let them debate something, you will find people going in all different directions. And it's actually quite natural for people to fight each other. And by the way, when I had Jewish friends, my Jewish friend used to try to convince me that the Jewish people are constantly fighting each other. He'd say, oh, we can fight each other for 25 years, but they don't actually go and shoot each other, but they will argue. And it is normal for groups of humans to argue. It's normal part of DNA. And the fact that they argue or even kill each other does not disprove the DNA and racial thing. I just wanted to make that point.
Yes, we're really, what we're having, we're coming into a debate about Darwinism. That's pretty much what this is turning into. I'm just to throw out one issue I'm going to contest with you. The mind cannot evolve. Okay, the mind had to come in fully blown at the very beginning. The main characteristic of human beings is speech. Speech cannot evolve. If you have two human beings, let's say Adam and Eve, okay? When Adam came into existence, then Eve came into existence, they had to be able to talk to each other. The first thing they said, Adam said, was when he saw Eve, was probably, hey, how are you? And Eve probably said, okay, how are you? That could not evolve. That had to be there from the beginning. And so what we're really debating here is evolution. And I think it has a distorting effect on the topic, which is the Jews, which I see as a theological construct. And I don't see that it's going to solve the problem. As I said before, I can't change my DNA. No one can change their DNA. And if DNA is the problem, you have to exterminate me. If my DNA is the problem, you have to exterminate me because I can't change it. You can't persuade me. Persuasion doesn't mean anything. I'm just a mindless automaton that's being ordered around by my DNA. I think that's preposterous. And I think that we have to break with this failed ideology, this failed Anglo ideology is bankrupt. It's over. And we're never going to come to a solution if that's going to be the basis of our program. Never going to happen.
Well, if I may say, Dr. Jones, take, for example, the United States. The United States, in its current form, is a creation of Western European people who moved to another continent, started colonizing it, and the story of the United States is an amazing story. It's actually What happened in North America, especially in the USA, is probably the most wondrous conquest ever undertaken by European people ever, in terms of speed, scale, etc. And when Western Europeans went into North America, they started clashing with the Indians. And in the end, what happened? In the end, the Europeans came in number, and using their abilities and their science and their military power, they had to crush these people. And today, Indians are a minority. They live on their reservations or whatever. They got a few rights, etc. But they were crushed by Western European people. That is how that problem was resolved. And I look at things from the perspective of history and what is possible in history. And the bad news that I come out seeing from history is that people in groups come into conflict with each other, and in the end you can't talk things out. In the end, things come to blows. The Jews are a very interesting, that's why I say the Jews are a very fascinating parasite who survived in Europe and developed in Europe. And they've been driven out, and they've even come back in again, and so forth. But they are a parasite. And I must tell you, just as my observation from Africa, I've seen the Jews work very hard on blacks and other people in Africa. And do you know that despite the Jews working intensely on blacks to try and manipulate them and control them, Jews are less successful at controlling other races than they are when it comes to influencing whites. And I'll tell you as well that white Christians, like in South Africa, white Christians looked up to Israel, and white Christians also look up to Jews as a biblical people.
Okay. This is a topic close to my heart because I'm writing a book now about American identity. And by American, I'm talking about the United States of America. But that's not all of America. And so I was in the... I'm just south of Michigan. I was up at the Straits of Mackinac. There was a fort there called Fort Michimilli Mackinac. There's a video. The video is sponsored by the state of Michigan. Okay? This is the official statement of the state of Michigan. It's the history of Fort Michimilli Mackinac. And it begins with a picture of a Catholic priest marrying a voyageur, the French fur trader, and an Indian. Okay, this was New France. Okay, I live in what used to be New France. Okay, there was a total integration of the native Indian population and the French population to the point where everyone in Quebec was part Indian and part French. This is what happened. Okay, so the story proceeds. The English conquer New France. Wolfe takes Quebec. Okay, and that's it. And now they got this English government. This is a different operating system. It's now we have the Protestants taking over. The first thing the Protestants do when they take over Fort Michimilli Mackinac is install a Jew as the head of the trading post. The Jew then proceeds to cheat the Indians. So the Indians don't like it, and they're out playing whatever they are, high lie or something like that, and they throw the ball over the stockade, and they knock on the door, please let us in to get the ball. They open the gate, and the Indians come in and slaughter every single person in that fort, including the Jew. And then the chief declares, we are no longer subject to the King of England. We are now going back to our original position. We are subject to the King of France. This is the real narrative of what happened in the American, North America. And it's not the Whig history of white people. There were no white people here. there were French Catholics and there were English Protestants, and they hated each other. And they fought a war, and the French Catholics lost. So when they lost, the English show up, and they're Presbyterians, and they show up on Nova Scotia, and all of the people there, all the French, have intermarried with the Mi'kmaq. Okay, and they speak fluent Mi'kmaq. And the Presbyterians come and say, now we're bringing you the gospel. You're going to convert. No, no, we're already Christians. And the French then put bounties on any Frenchman to scout. The English had free reign to scout the French. And when that didn't work, they shipped them off to Louisiana, where they became Cajuns. This is the real history. Okay, it's not racial. It's religious. That is the history of the United States of America. It was taken over by regicides, English regicides, and I'm talking about the Puritans who killed the king. These people were Judaizers. They thought they were Jews. Milton is their poet. John Milton wrote Paradise Lost. The hero of Paradise Lost is Satan. And this is the hidden grammar of America, because the Jews took over America, this middle part that is known as the United States, by the successful warlike colonization of a group of Judaizers known as Puritans, and that has cast the destiny of the United States ever since.
Well, that is certainly a take on American history I look forward to reading. I have never heard anyone else express it before. I want to say quickly, to break in here and say, if there is anybody in the chat room who has a question for Dr. Jones or Jan Lamprecht, please do put it in the chat room, either the Discord chat room or the LibertyNet chat room at 3950.net. And while people may be composing questions, could both of you gentlemen, starting with you, Dr. Jones, tell us, since we're coming up against less than half an hour left now in our program, how can people learn more about your ideas and your work?
Go to fidelitypress.org. That's the only place. You have to go to fidelitypress.org. And all of my books are available, including The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, which is the thesis that I've been expounding tonight. And my latest book, which is called The Holocaust Narrative, which explains how the Jewish narrative got imposed on the United States of America and all of Europe after World War II. So it's fidelitypress.org.
All right. And is there any other URL or publication that people should be reading, in your opinion?
Well, you can also subscribe to Culture Wars magazine. And you can go to culturewars.com and subscribe to the magazine and look at the world not through a lens of 2,000 years, but like what happened yesterday or what happened this month, and how are we going to deal with that in light of the principles I've articulated in these books.
Okay, thank you very much. And I want to ask the same questions to Jan Lamprecht. Where can people read your work, and where do you think people should be reading just to find out more about this important issue? And I'll just add, I'm delighted that two men, and really more than two men in the LibertyNet and all our audience, are seeing the Jews as the enemy, even if we may differ about how to deal with the situation. So go ahead, Jan.
Thank you very much. My main website is called historyreviewed.best or historyreviewed.com. Both of those URLs work. And a secondary website of mine is africancrisis.info. And the only book that I've ever written on political type of stuff is a book called Government by Deception, which is again on sale. It was a book that I wrote 20 years ago warning white South Africans about what lies ahead.
Thank you very much, Jan and Dr. Jones. And I wanted to also say that a very fascinating article on Jewish psychology, it's a short read, it's easy to read, it's very fast, but very deep, is Andrew Hamilton's article entitled Empathy Without Sympathy. Empathy being the ability to put yourself in the other fellow's shoes, to feel what he's feeling, in a sense, to know what he's feeling, certainly, and to perhaps even know what he's thinking, to empathize. And usually among Europeans, empathy goes with sympathy. When you can do that, when you can feel what the other guy is feeling and understand it deeply, understand his thinking and his emotions, then you tend to sympathize with him more. Whereas the Jews as a people seem to have the empathy. They know what we're thinking. They know how we feel. They know how we get to the point where we feel a certain thing, but they do not sympathize. In fact, they use it against us. So I'll just throw that out there. Empathy Without Sympathy by Andrew Hamilton can easily be found via an internet search. Don't use Google. It's Jewish controlled. The best search engine, in my opinion, is flawlesslogic.com. And you can find out a lot of good things at Flawless Logic. Look up Empathy Without Sympathy. Okay, I am looking in the chat room, and I see that Natalie has very kindly provided a link to historyreview.com and africancrisis.info. And so thank you, Natalie, but I don't see any questions. Is there anybody in our voice chat room, Natalie or Steve? Do you have any questions for either of these gentlemen? If so, unmute yourself and speak up.
Yeah. Evan, I got a question for Mr. Jones.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, my head is swimming here. I can't believe the amount of material that's coming in, and I'm kind of dotting the I's and crossing the T's here. Both of you have answered, and Kevin as well, answered a lot of questions that I've wondered about. And I guess along the lines of the Jews being, I've heard this on social media a lot, they've been booted out of 109 countries. And I guess, you know, there's this saying, you know, we're going to be number 110. That's the goal. And I'm wondering if that number is about accurate in your studies, and also about the Spain, I think what they did after they got out of Spain. I think you said they had gone to Poland, but I also think a lot of them had gone to the Ottoman Empire, and I believe they were accepted into that Ottoman Empire, which is basically, I believe, Muslim. And of course, I've sort of connected the dots. Wherever they go, they eventually bring war with them. And of course, the Ottoman Empire was, I think, fell apart after World War One. I think there might have been the start of World War One around that time. So I'm wondering your thoughts on those connections there with the Ottoman Empire and the Muslims. They seem to work hand in hand with the Muslims. I know now they've got this ISIS, which is basically Muslim related, and they seem to morph. ISIS seems to morph back and forth, and they're claiming, you know, ISIS is doing this, ISIS is doing that. So I guess that's sort of my analogy there. I'm wondering if I'm accurate with that. Over to you.
Okay, the first thing is that the disputation of Tortosa is about 300 years before the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. So the disputation is the time when the Jews left. Okay, and that was the beginning of the time when they converted. By the time you get to the Inquisition, there was an attempt to find out what happened. You know, are these people really sincere? It failed, and at that point, the Philip and Isabella, Ferdinand and Isabella, just would kick them out, and that did not solve the problem. It exported the problem. It exported it to two places, as you mentioned. One was to Turkey, where the Jews settled along those cities along the coast. The other one was to Spanish Netherlands, where they connived with the local Judaizers, known as the Calvinists, the Dutch Calvinists, who I think are the source of the Boers in South Africa. But anyway, they collaborated with them in an insurrection against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, against the Habsburg. That was put down, but only in the southern part, only in the Spanish border, the Spanish Netherlands. The northern provinces, the Spanish army could not get over all those rivers there, and so they cut them loose, and that became the Dutch Calvinist Republic of Holland. And the Dutch Calvinists were the beginnings of capitalism, and then they allied with the English until they fought a war with the English. Anyway, so we're talking about a complete later development. Spain exported the problem. they didn't have the problem anymore. They exported the problem. And when the Jews went to Turkey, they were called the Dome Map, which is the Turkish word for Converso. And the great hero of the Dome was Shabbatai Zvi, who basically every Jewish synagogue in Europe declared him the Messiah. He rose up against the Caliph, and the Caliph said, well, if you're the Messiah, I have my archers here, and these arrows won't hurt you. At that point, he converted to Islam. So you have, again, the problem of insincere conversion. So when Shabbatai Zvi got back to his followers, he says, no, I was just kidding. I'm still a Jew. I didn't convert to Islam. And you have this fatal, confusion that resulted from the fact that they are not sincere. They tolerate. The rabbis tolerate insincere conversion. That is not to say that there aren't sincere Jewish converts. I know them. They're throughout history. And we could talk about them, too. But you have to make this distinction.
Anything else, Steve?
Okay. I was also, I guess the end of the question was more or less about the Muslim connection. And I guess, is that what you're calling the conversos, is where the Muslims and the Jews?
Let me go back. So at the time of the Reconquista, when Ferdinand and Isabella are trying to unite all of Spain, which had been conquered by the Moors, the Jews were collaborating with the Moors. There's no question about it. They were a fifth column in there, and they were collaborating with the Moors. And they are traditionally have always worked with the Muslims up to the founding of the State of Israel, which basically broke that collaboration. The Jews, as I said, became a fifth column within Turkey, known as the Dome. And the Dome were basically, by the time you got to World War I, the Dome had all become Jewish revolutionaries. They had all gone to schools in Russia. They made contact with Jewish revolutionaries in the Narodnaya Volia. The same thing was happening with the Armenians. The one thing that the Armenians and the Turks had in common at the time of the Armenian genocide was basically all of these young radicals are all going to schools, universities in Russia, and learning to become revolutionaries and groups like Narodnaya Volia. And so when the Armenians come back to the Ottoman Empire during World War I, they immediately ally themselves with the Russians because they're nationalists as well as Bolsheviks. And that immediately sets off the genocide question, because the Turks cannot allow a fifth column on their eastern border allowing the Russians in. And that set off the Armenian genocide. So that, too, is traceable to Jews who traceable to the Jewish revolutionary spirit. There's no other way to talk about it. And the fact of the matter was that, as with the Puritans, there were Armenians who converted to the Jewish revolutionary spirit, and it ended up being a civil war between two groups of Jewish revolutionaries.
Dr. Jones, is there any example in history, clearly you are well-versed in history, of a successful conversion of the Jews, or what is the most successful conversion of the Jews that has happened?
I've already mentioned it. The mass conversions that took place after the disputations, like the disputation of Tortosa, which took place in Spain, there were rabbis who converted. There has never been a time when rabbis have not converted to the original plan for Jews. From 1260, at the beginning of this process, Rabbi Nicholas Donin is taken by the head of the Dominicans to meet with Pope Gregory the Ninth. And he says to Gregory the Ninth, do you know what's in the Talmud? And Gregory the Ninth says, what's the Talmud? And then he explains him all the blasphemies. And at this point, Gregory the Ninth says to Raymond of Pentaforte, who's the head of the Dominicans, well, you confiscate these books of the Jews. And if you read them and find that what this rabbi is saying is true, burn them. I said this to a group of Dominicans. I said, it's time to get back to your original charism, guys. Start burning the Talmud. Nobody thought that was funny. I thought it was funny, but none of the Dominicans thought it was funny because they are alienated from their own tradition. I felt like saying, but wait a minute, guys, are you telling me you're superior to St. Thomas Aquinas? Because Raymond of Penaforte turned to Thomas Aquinas after the Pope said this and said, you need to write a book to convert the Jews. And that was the Summa Contra Gentiles. So you're superior to Thomas Aquinas? This is the problem with the Catholic Church right now. It is alienated from its own tradition on a crucial question of whether the Jews need to convert, need to be baptized in order to be saved.
Okay, thank you. Let me get another question to Jan. And Jan, you haven't stated yet that there has been any successful countermeasures against the Jews, such as conversion or such as biological elimination, which Dr. Jones has brought up as the undesirable alternative. What do you see as the most successful approach that has been tried so far? And do you suggest anything for the future in dealing with this enemy?
Thank you very much, Kevin. I regard the work of Hitler and the Nazis, the Germans, I regard that as the greatest work that's been done. And what I really like about them is they come from a thorough scientific and historical perspective, and they approach life that way. And when I look at the things that they do, I think that when we talk about solving the Jewish problem, like in many cases, when you're dealing with huge problems, it isn't easy to solve the entire problem in one step. So I think we need to look at multiple steps. I think the starting point is to follow the ideas of a guy like Goebbels. I have incredible respect for Dr. Goebbels. Dr. Goebbels was a fantastic communicator. And it was Goebbels who also said that you must use the word Jew. You must call them by their name. So the first thing that I would say is, let's talk about whether you could call it political warfare or cultural warfare. That on the political and cultural warfare levels, which is basically free speech, that in that area, we must use the term Jew. We mustn't use things like bankers, elites, capitalists, this, that, the other. You must focus clearly on calling them what they are, because if you use any of these other code words, Jews are like an eel, okay? And if you try to hold on to these slippery people, they will slip out and they'll come up with new stories and new lies, etc. So the first thing is to focus people on the fact that Jews are the issue, and that, you know, everything relating to them, that is the thing, that you can't let them escape by talking about Zionists and this and that. That Jews as a people, there's an issue that needs to be understood. I do agree with you, Dr. Jones. Judaism is the core of their hideous evil thinking. And I myself have said in the past that I regard rabbis as the root of all evil, because those rabbis reading their scriptures, teaching their people, that is where their hatred and all their things come from. And this is also why I think the Spanish, why I have such respect for the Spanish getting rid of the religion of Judaism, basically banning it, as I understand it. But I think in modern times, we need to follow the works of the Nazis, because they solved problems. And the first thing is no code words. You need to call these people out, name these people, and point people to them, because the vast majority of whites don't even realize how many Jews are moving around in positions of power and what they are doing and what they are getting up to. And the second thing is that after after the culture war or the war of words or the political war, I think that the Jewish problem ultimately can only be solved at a governmental level, that you will ultimately have to have government doing things, whether it is making laws or something like that. But I think that governments are, eventually this becomes a government problem, that the problem is of such a nature that the common person does not have the power to carry out those things. High-level decisions have to be made. Dr. Jones, you are quite right in saying that when Jews are smashed down in one place like Spain, that they run off somewhere else and they start their nonsense all over in other countries. And when I look at Jews, I see that as part of their survival mechanism, that Jews are a state, they are a state inside your state, but Jews are also nomadic. Hitler himself pointed out that Jews are nomadic. He said, Jews can live in this city today, in that city tomorrow. You know, they move around between countries. And Hitler pointed out that the common person in any country does not have that option. But Jews function like that. So I see them as I see the power structure of Jews as being unique, because they don't exist just in one country, and if they get smashed in that country, they survive by running away to another place. And they are constantly also looking for new places where they will be welcome. So they've actually got many, many places where they can go and create new mayhem. Perhaps in this age of global communication could help massively to stop this nonsense, so that when Jews flee out of one country to another country, that the people in the receiving country already know that there's an issue. By the way, there's something I've forgotten to do. I remember it now and then, is that in South Africa, in 1939, there was a speech in Parliament where, in 1939, Jews were already fleeing from Germany, etc. And there was a speech in Parliament given by a Boer where he actually pointed out that South Africa should not be accepting Jews into South Africa. And he went through a whole list of all the problems that these people create in other countries. And even when the Jews were fleeing to America, there were quotas restricting how many Jews could get into America. And I saw that some Jews then would go to another place, and then from that place they'd get into America. So their survival mechanism when everything falls apart is that they are stretched out across the globe, and that a single country does not have the power to reach out and touch them everywhere where they are. And that has been their survival mechanism. And when they flee from one country, then there's another country that's willing to accept them. So that has been their survival mechanism. But I think in this global age, I think it may become harder, or they'll have to go more underground in order to survive. But I also want to just add a final point. Hitler and the Nazis were busy teaching their people. And I do see education. I see education as a critical, critical thing across the Western world, because education is very important so that people can understand our historical problems and also this particular problem.
Let me break in just for a moment and say that for me, the best educational resources are the works of Dr. William Pierce, and they're available at nationalvanguard.org. Gentlemen, we have areas of disagreement. We have the primary issue of our age. We seem to see the correct enemy. And we have one question or a request from the audience. What were you doing and what were your thoughts when you first heard of the 9/11 attacks. As for me, I was eating breakfast, and I realized within a few hours that this operation had something to do with the Middle East, Israel, and starting a war. So I think that's probably unusual, but I'm so even in that year in 2001, I was so suspicious of the Jewish entity that I suspected they had a hand in this to start another war. Dr. Jones, your final thoughts?
Yeah, I just come back from a rowing tour down the Danube. I rode down the Danube with a bunch of Germans. I had met them, lived in Germany for 3 years. I speak fluent German, and it was a great experience. All I want to say is the best thing that ever happened to the Jews is Adolf Hitler. If Adolf Hitler didn't exist, the Jews would have had to invent him. And I'm saying now that if you go down that road, you will fail. I'll give you an example. The whole debacle of Charlottesville in the United States of America happened because these people identified themselves as white, and they didn't understand that white people have no rights in America. You have no rights if you're an American. And so the image I used there was Richard Spencer handed out spears and told these people to charge the machine gun nest. I got that image from a movie called Zulu. It's the story of Rourke's drift, and it wasn't a machine gun. It was volley firing. They were single shot Martini rifles, and so they had to, you know, reload and so on and so forth. That is not an accurate presentation of what happened at Rourke's Drift. And one of the movies that came out after that was Zulu Dawn. It came out about 10 years later. And that gave an accurate position, an accurate description of what happened to Etlis Islandlvana. The English were slaughtered because they underestimated the power of the Zulu. Now, they didn't set up a perimeter. They were just overconfident, and 30,000 Zulus showed up, and they fired a couple rounds. And then once the Zulus broke through the line, it was a battle between the technological odds were even, because it was a battle between the bayonet and the assegai. And that's what happened. They slaughtered the entire English regiment. And I'm saying that this is the story of the first Zulu. I wrote an article about it. It's in Culture Wars, if you want to read it, the latest issue of Culture Wars. The first Zulu across the line changed the battle. And I'm saying that's happening right now. I said Thomas Massie, when he was interviewed by Tucker Carlson, was the first Zulu in Congress.
Yes.
Because he got reelected. He defied AIPAC and he got reelected. He's the first Zulu to break the line. He said it's possible. The second Zulu was Candace Owen, and I don't know whether you saw the debate. She crushed Rabbi Shmuley in this debate. I'm saying this is happening right now, okay? And it's the Zulu solution, if you want to talk about it that way. Once the first Zulu gets through, the entire preventive perimeter collapses, and we're watching that right now. We're watching it happen right now, and I hope we contributed to it by our discussion.
Yeah, thank you. And Jan, your final thoughts?
Yes, please. Well, all I want to say is that I hear what Dr. Jones is saying about Hitler, and it's sort of, let's say, a liberal type of interpretation about Hitler. But I will say that Hitler is not the end. Hitler is just the beginning of something much bigger. And that the things that he started are far from over. And I do want to just address this issue of race, because I've been reading various things written by American academics, and there are American academics that I've taken an interest in. Professor Carol Quigley was a guy that I was very interested in, and I even read his book about the evolution of civilization. And Victor Davis Hanson is another academic that I quite like. And I read these guys, even though I don't agree with like Quigley, because there are things hidden there inside Quigley's works that I think are very important. But Victor Davis Hanson is a modern American academic with a great understanding of history. And I was reading his book about the Greeks. And one thing that comes clear to me about America, and I just want to raise this issue as a big American issue, something that's going to burn all of you in the future. And it is the issue of race. That I noticed, for example, with Victor Davis Hanson and all kinds of American academics, and the one thing, the one hot potato they stay away from, they run away from it like crazy. And Victor Davis Hanson even pointed out, he said that, you know, it's best to not talk about this. So white Americans deal with race by saying, we better not talk about this. Let's keep our mouths shut about this. The more we talk about it, the worse it's going to get. So let's all be silent. And I want to tell you that that approach is not a wise approach. And that I live in Africa, and I've studied our history and watched all our stuff, and I've seen entire nations flip from white rule to black rule and all the results, eh? I want to tell you something, that in South Africa, we tried, we were forced. We were forced by America and liberal powers and the West. We were forced to integrate with blacks and others, and we had to live with them, co-work with them in ways that we'd not done before. I want to tell you something. 30 years later, race is still there. Race is real. I've watched all of Africa. I've watched black people, Asian people, mixed race people. I want to tell you, race is real, and you cannot wish this thing away. The reason you Americans are able to wish it away for now and to hide it is because there are, of your population of 340 million, 200 million are Europeans. And you are very successful, and you are very successful and very powerful because you are the country in the world with the biggest single population of Europeans in one country. So you're extremely successful and extremely powerful as a single country. However, I have lived in places where whites make up 4% of the population. And I want to tell you that you people think that you people have somehow fooled yourselves or been conned into believing that if you avoid the issue of race, that your outcome is going to be better. And I do understand why all of you have to avoid race. You have to avoid race because of the American Civil War. You have to avoid race because you are now a global power. Your government, your businesses, your military have to go to countries all across the world, and you are trying to deal with them in a peaceful way. So you have to go and talk to them in ways that do not offend them. So you people, being a global power, you are now in your, you are doing what nature wants. Okay. I'm not saying you're doing it wrong. You are doing the right thing by wanting power. And you've got power, and you are expanding your power. But you are doing it by trying to do it through cooperating with all kinds of other people. But you will see with time that as the Jews, and look at the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, etc., pumping non-whites into your country, Christian organizations bringing in non-whites, and you people are flooding yourselves. You people are being flooded with non-whites. You are thinking that by treating them the way that you are treating them, that you are going to be able to come out of this better. I want to warn you that other things happen when power starts shifting. As you whites become less, and as you become weaker and they become stronger, you will find that everyone's going to change, including the non-whites in your country. They will turn on you. Race is a real thing, and you people are just fooling yourselves. And by avoiding race, you're going to have a problem where you're always going to be on the retreat. You're always going to be running away from race. But that thing is real. And whether it's 20 years, 50 years, 150 years, that thing is going to come to burn you all. And I saw with Victor Davis Hanson, these guys try by all means to avoid it, but you cannot avoid it. And race is the one area where the European people as a whole have lost the argument. We have never really stood up on this particular issue. Everyone in every country folded except for the Germans. So that's my last word.
Thank you, Jan. And since that was more or less of a rebuttal to what Dr. Jones says, I'm going to let Dr. Jones have one more round, even though we've gone a little over seven. That's okay. We're not on a strict time schedule. Dr. Jones?
Yes. What Jan just talked about is what happens when you let Jews control the racial issue. That is the source of the problem. The Jews have been, ever since they achieved a modicum of power in the United States of America, they tried to turn the blacks into revolutionaries. The blacks became the proxy revolutionaries for the Jews. And so I'm saying we have to focus on the source of the problem. It's the Jews. It's not the blacks. Certainly not in America. It is not the blacks. It's the Jews. And they're forever trying to create proxy warriors. It was the beginning, it was the blacks, and then it was the women with feminism, and then it's the homosexuals as the proxy warriors. The Jews are the problem. Race is not the problem here. The Jews are the problem.
Well, I have a slightly different view, but I agree that Jews are the primary problem. And I don't want to take any more of anybody's time. And I will say, frankly, that I have three young children, 4 years old, 2.5, and 1 year old, that are waiting for daddy to put them to bed. So I cannot stay much longer, but I want to express my deep thanks to you, Dr. Jones, for being on our LibertyNet team up. I hope it has been something that has further immunized our listeners and enlightened our listeners to the nature of the enemy and the scope of the problem. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank you also, Jan, for your unique perspective, your incisive words, and your thought-provoking ideas. Thank you for taking your late night in your country to be with us here on the LibertyNet team up.
Thank you very much for having me on this show. It was very awesome. And Dr. Jones, it's been very nice meeting you, and I've really enjoyed this. We might differ on some things, but I do have a great admiration for your work and respect for your work. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody, I want to say thank you, and especially thank you to Steve for setting this whole thing up. And good night, and we'll end the show here. Have a wonderful evening, and let us continue our consciousness raising about this issue of all issues, Jewish power. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening today. I hope that you learned something new today. Look after yourselves and take care. We'll be chatting again soon.
give up, my friend. If you don't see the end, if you don't see the top, don't stop. We know you'll win. Every fight you fight, every game you play, you will reach the top.